Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Hey, good. How are you, David?
Doing well. Another exciting week. It seems like the week that there's so many news events happening, and then you realize that that's just kind of how it is in this really ever-changing market and environment.
Well, ever since the bull run started, and really in earnest since the ETF approval in January, the news cycle in Bitcoin has been really compelling. I mean, we obviously both have day jobs actually building Bitcoin software, and doing that at the same time as keeping a track of everything going on has been quite a challenge in a good way. Yesterday was an amazing day actually for Bitcoin, but also a mixed one. Like, it's amazing because of the court case, which we'll get into. But then we also had this like run up in the price. We set an all time high, and then there was like a drawdown. So it's just quite a roller coaster.
Yeah, definitely. Do you want to dive right into everything that's been going on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're the one that noticed this. Brought it to my attention. I didn't realize it was actually yesterday this week marks the 1 year anniversary from the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. How has it already been a year? Things are going so fast.
It feels like it's gone by so quickly, and there haven't been as cascading of bank failures as some might have predicted. I remember in the wake of Silicon Valley Bank failing, Balaji Srivastava predicted a $1 million Bitcoin price.
Yep.
As all the banks collapsed, mm-hmm. And he wrote some pretty compelling posts about those. However, that didn't come to fruition, but I still think that the underlying fragility that Balaji identified is still there. It's just this, the problem with poking holes in the fiat world is that it often doesn't come to fruition when you think. It often comes later and unexpectedly.
Right. Gradually, yeah. Then suddenly, right? I mean, you don't know when the suddenly is going to happen, but that doesn't mean that your model for how there is systemic risk, and the systemic risk has persisted since Silicon Valley Bank's collapse. It hasn't really been fixed at all. Mm-hmm. You're not wrong to point that out. And on the flip side of that, though, you know, I've used this term before. I saw it. I didn't make it up. Zero hedge brain. Like, don't get zero hedge brain and just sort of like dismiss the fact that the fiat system worked to recover its some semblance of stability in the short term, right? Like, there are tremendously smart people who are trying their best to keep this house of cards standing, and they did. And credit to them. I mean, they didn't cause like a big meltdown where people are now in breadlines or, tremendous political disruption and so on. So credit to them for keeping it together. That doesn't change like my opinion or Balaji's analysis that it is a house of cards. It's unstable. And, you know, keeping it upright is an ongoing task that's extremely expensive and eventually can't go on forever because the systemic risk, not only is it still there, but you know, the debt, I mean, the increase in the debt, we saw something where now the amount of money that we spend to service the debt is growing so dramatically. I saw a really interesting chart go by. Maybe I can try to pull it up, but it was saying, you know, that the amount that we're adding to the debt is rising so fast that if we're not in a debt spiral, we will be soon.
Yeah, it's an interesting macro environment that we find ourselves in, driven by monetary policy. And that's the CPI report that was released on or that came out this week. It was obviously not a little bit higher than what estimates were predicting or what analysts were estimating. However, it doesn't seem to have changed the Fed's stance that they're likely not going to cut rates until the summer, but everybody's still predicting at least like one rate cut in June, July, something like that.
So would it be fair? So what's interesting too is kind of the question about whether they lower rates. I think there's a underlying question, which is, how much is the Fed politicized, right? So we've stated before on this podcast, and I mean, I do believe that it is politicized, even if it's not explicitly so, where there's a backroom deal, smoke-filled rooms, and people talking about keeping Biden in power. I don't think it's that explicit, but I do think that there is such, there's an accepted set of, there's an accepted assumption that Donald Trump very well may be elected, and that's extremely undesirable because he has these, you know, according to them, these tyrannical impulses. And so they don't have to say it, but everybody's kind of rowing in the same direction. Everybody's aligned on that. And so in that sense, it is politicized, for better or for worse. And so then you ask yourself, okay, so now how will they show their cards? Will they show that they're political? If the CPI comes in, and the CPI underestimates inflation tremendously. So if CPI comes in and says, and CPI is high, real inflation's way higher. We can all pretty much count on that.
Or, yeah.
Right. Well, how would you qualify that?
I would qualify it and say that, like, yeah, inflation is different for everybody because everybody purchases their own basket. And however, like the CPI basket is, and the way that it's measured is likely understates the true increases in the price level relative to like most people's baskets.
That's because they keep taking things out of the basket when they get too inflated, right?
Yeah, like it's a politicized measure.
Okay, that's for sure. Okay, so then if the Fed's using that implicitly or explicitly, then it's making political decisions, whether or not it intends to. And then you say, okay, well, so inflation is important to people. It's a hidden tax. It harms savers. It harms people who use cash as a store of value, which is typically the least privileged, right? I mean, if you are upper class, upper middle class, mm-hmm. middle class, you probably have investments in equities that track, you know, core inflation and prevent you from losing too much money. But if you have cash in a bank account, which is frankly what a lot of people do, you're being harmed. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so that's like, if you're doing the right thing by people who are vulnerable, you are laser focused on that. So if they cut rates, I'm just saying, if they cut rates even at all, given this data, to me, that is contrary to the interests of a lot of poorer people and middle class people, and it coincidentally serves the interests of the incumbent president. So it's not that they're helping keep Biden in power. It's just sort of this. It's the way things shake out because everything's political and they're all aligned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I think that's very fair to say. In addition to that, unfortunately, the Biden administration is also rowing in sync with Elizabeth Warren. And the Biden administration released their planned budget, which is, of course, qualifying that is not a done deal. It's kind of like the first price on the negotiating table. Basically, Right. There's so much stuff in this budget that is just completely out of bounds and won't be approved by Congress. So this is, it's kind of like the first draft. However, it reintroduces the excise mining tax on energy, which is like a huge tax on miners and would make that industry a lot more challenging to operate in the United States. It applies the wash sale rule on digital assets, which is like a tax rule that, you know, you can't sell for a loss and then, you know, buy it again within like the next day and just like have that that tax loss on your books to like basically do what's called tax loss harvesting. This anti-wash sale rule is basically like, you know, removing tax loss harvesting for digital assets, which is not, I personally don't view this like as that harmful. However, there's also some new reporting requirements for digital asset brokers, but the real big thing was the these anti-mining taxes that were proposed, and it's similar to the energy reporting requirements that Elizabeth Warren, basically how that happened is last a couple of weeks ago we discussed that the Department of Energy was going to require all of this information from Bitcoin miners in these like surveys, and what they were going to ask about, it was so probing that it would be almost like illegal for the miners to provide them with this information. But basically what happened is that Elizabeth Warren had asked the energy secretary about this information a couple of years ago during a hearing. And there was the department, they like realized that I think there was going to be like another hearing coming up where she would likely ask them about this again. And I think they wanted to avoid that. So they rushed out the survey and did a really poor job of doing it that the miners were able to take it to the courts and get it stopped. And it's emblematic of this basically every angle attack on Bitcoin in the United States that has been going on. And it's not good for the US, basically.
Yeah. No, and it's, well, and it's also not good for, if you think that Bitcoin's inevitable, it's not good for the people who are even launching the attack, because they'll lose so much credibility through the process. You know, Bitcoin, there's no reason that it has to be political. And I think a lot of the people who are even like more of the radical left from the 60s era would even agree with a lot of the political change that Bitcoin promises.
Yeah.
And yet today we have the mainstream sort of uniparty, which, let's be honest, is dominated by Democrats fighting Bitcoin. And then you have, in contrary to that, right? Because of course politics, you're always trying to build coalitions. So now there's a large number of people who are not served by the Uniparty or Democrat Party who are fighting Bitcoin, and they're Bitcoin enthusiasts. And so now those people are now consolidating around this kind of this wing of the Republican Party, like a small wing or growing wing that's like Vivek and Trump. So Trump just came out this week and said something positive on Bitcoin, right? He said, I like one thing, and that's the powerful dollar. Okay, so he had to put that out there. But then he's like, I'm indifferent to Bitcoin, which is before he said Bitcoin's not money. And now he says he's indifferent to it and he can live with it. It's a big change.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think, you know, I guess he has seen that people are buying his new kicks, his golden Trump shoes, and I guess some people are paying in Bitcoin. So, you know, if you want those, might be powerful. If you want those shoes and you like Bitcoin, maybe pay for them in Bitcoin. I know it'll be like a taxable event, but pay for them. And maybe Trump will see it and it'll soften his stance even further.
And I don't know what to think about that. Like, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. But if it is true, how awesome is that? That you have somebody who's like, I'm forming an opinion as I see market activity that I'm involved with. Like, that's a big difference, instead of being like, my consultants did a poll and this is what I'm supposed to say. So anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of his appeal. Building off of that, actually, do you grill at all?
Sure.
Okay. Do you know the company Traeger?
Yeah. The pellet grills makers.
Yeah. So this morning it actually came out that Traeger, in a 10K or a 10Q, that they are listing that they are going to accept Bitcoin they may or may not accept Bitcoin for their products in the future, and then they may or may not sell the proceeds that they receive. So
interesting.
The next MicroStrategy could be Traeger. Just saying. Which I don't know. I love that. I don't have the space to have a Traeger, but like, once I do, it's a done deal. It's a fantastic product. So
one day they're going to sell pellets made out of US dollars when they're worthless, and that'll be
I don't know if I want those chemicals on the meat, you know, but those are like the dirtiest things in the world, not just like spiritually, but like physically they're very dirty. And then in addition to all of that, another big thing that like it seems like everybody in the Bitcoin community is fairly, I think that there's a disconnect between the people who work and live in the Bitcoin space and those that are kind of in parallel to it or a little bit less connected with respect to the who is Satoshi question. If you talk like a lot of people who aren't as deeply involved in the space, they will still say things like, oh, well, you know, Jamie Dimon said, what if Satoshi comes back in the year 2140 when all of the Bitcoin is mined and then he just changes it? Which
I can't believe that.
It's kind of ridiculous. But we do know that, or at least a court ruled that Satoshi is not Craig Wright. That was the lead up to that statement.
You know what's kind of interesting to me is how many people are saying, oh, he's not Satoshi because the UK court said that. Like, appeal to authority. Like, do we really have to appeal to authority to that extent? I mean, if you look at what he said and what he's done over the years, it's abundantly clear to anybody. And so, I guess people were just, they didn't want to say it. I didn't want to say it because you don't want to get sued.
Yeah.
I guess so. But it just sort of, I was a little bit disappointed that it took somebody wearing a robe and a wig for us to be able to like speak the truth. I don't know. It kind of rubs me the wrong way. It makes me think that we really are in this kind of post-truth, like appeal to authority era. But anyways.
Yeah. Well, appeal to whose authority, I think, is an interesting question because, I think we'll only see, I don't know. I think that breakdown could go in different ways, especially, you know, as we have seen with Google's botched LLM. If that's your source of authority, you might be being misled.
Yeah.
But if your authority is, you know, something else, so it's interesting. The only trust is the Bitcoin time chain. I don't know. So there were a few interesting adoption stories this week. Marsha Blackburn, who is a senator from Tennessee, she's actually speaking at the Bitcoin Policy Summit, which is interesting. I didn't know that Marsha Blackburn was pro Bitcoin.
I didn't either.
Senators I knew were Cynthia Lummis and Ted Cruz.
Yeah,
and I I would assume Rand Paul, although he's a little less outspoken about it.
Yeah.
But just given his other positions, I have to assume that he's very pro-Bitcoin.
Yeah. Do you know if Rand, do you know if Ron Paul is?
I would assume definitely yeah. so. Yeah. He's older, so he's definitely got his like heritage in gold.
Yeah.
I highly doubt he's a naysayer. I've even witnessed gold people I know. They have went from criticizing Bitcoin to now qualifying their opinions about gold by saying, you know, gold is a certainty. I'm not talking about Bitcoin, which is on the same track as gold, but different.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the conversation has changed and the gold and Bitcoin communities are a little bit more in alignment, especially because the assets are uncorrelated. There is a fund out of Switzerland, I believe, called Incrementum AG, and they have a like dual Bitcoin and gold fund, and their thesis is that you can combine both to get a better like risk-adjusted return or something like that. And they were historically gold guys, and now they've made these new investment products. This is not investment advice, obviously, just highlighting that divergence.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. They publish a 500-page annual report called In Gold We Trust. And now the In Gold We Trust report has stuff about Bitcoin in it.
So. And then there's the In Bitcoin We Trust newsletter. So,
oh, there is?
That's a great one. Yeah, Sylvian Sorrell. I've been reading that for years. By the way, if you're listening, really great. It was one of the things that I was reading when I was first getting into this stuff, and I still check it out.
Wow, I had no idea about that newsletter. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah. Well, shall we leave it there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there weren't that many new things that happened besides the ones we covered. There was, I would say, there's a large upgrade, or I don't want to call it upgrade, a large change to Ethereum that allows, like, I think greater throughput or something like that, so that Ethereum can like compete with Solana or something like that. But it shows the divergence in stakeholders in Ethereum, where there's like the ones that want it to compete with Solana and these other blockchains. And then there are the ones that want like it to compete with Bitcoin. So it's like competing as like a tech platform and a like money. And it's like each upgrade satisfies different stakeholders. And it's this really like schizophrenic product roadmap that is challenging. So we're seeing like a continued struggle on that end. And to me, that highlights the monetary, like really the case for Bitcoin that is not like maintained by a team that has to satisfy a lot of stakeholders with opposing ends. And maybe people might say that does exist in Bitcoin, but I think it's different than Ethereum.
I do too. There's just, yeah. I mean, there's the ordinal people and so on, but it's not as mature an ecosystem, I guess. Like, that's not a dig on them, although I'm not a fan. I'm not trying to insult them when I say that. It's just there isn't like quite so much investment into these projects that have to use Bitcoin in that way as there is on Ethereum. There's also as we're talking about Ethereum, I saw some letter that was written either by the SEC or to the SEC it was Congress writing to the SEC or something, imploring them not to approve an Ethereum ETF.
Yeah.
What was that?
There were two senators who I don't think were, I had not heard of these senators before. So they were definitely not, I didn't think that these were crypto critics. Like Sherrod Brown and Elizabeth Warren are like huge known critics. However, they Yeah, they implored the SEC not to approve new products. I basically think that they're upset by the success of the Bitcoin ETFs, and they are, because they might not know anything about Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, etc. They might not know that they're totally different, and so they might be thinking like, "Oh my gosh, we just gotta stop this while we can," or something like that. Even though the case for an Ethereum ETF is just much, from an investment standpoint and a regulatory standpoint, very different than Bitcoin. I actually think that right now that there's not, I don't think that the SEC will approve the ETH ETF. I know a lot of people do. I know BlackRock is filing, but I think that they might not, because there's still unresolved questions about whether it's a commodity or a security. And
but there's ETFs that contain securities.
Yeah, definitely. I just think that I'll have to revisit why I came to this conclusion. I don't think the political case makes sense for Gary Gensler to approve these products.
Yeah.
So barring additional court decisions, I think that they might be harder pressed to do so.
It's interesting. Fred Krueger posted a while back on Twitter a few weeks ago, basically that if Ethereum ETFs are approved, then there's going to be it's going to kind of slow down Bitcoin adoption. It'll still be inevitable, but because institutions and sort of mid to low information investors are coming into crypto through the Bitcoin ETF now, they don't have a choice. They can only get Bitcoin, which really helps solidify Bitcoin's institutional support. If now there's a choice and now there's all of this analysis that has to take place about which one's doing better and this and that and the trade-offs, it just sort of muddies the water for a while, and it's going to cause Bitcoin's adoption to slow, although not inevitable. It won't change its long-term sort of where it ends up.
Potentially, although it does tie back into what we were talking about earlier, how there are big opposing stakeholders within the Ethereum community. And if an ETF were approved, you would have a swell in the ETH investor community that wants the tokens to be more of a competitor to Bitcoin, which is at odds with the ETH as a developer user platform for users to do a bunch of stuff on. And so that presents even more challenges for it.
And it's kind of ironic too that these people writing that we shouldn't approve Ethereum ETF are helping Bitcoin.
Yeah. It's a mess. But what's funny is remembering that Bitcoin still just functions regardless of all these things.
Yep.
It we're analyzing and talking and doing everything, and Bitcoin just keeps ticking. So.
Yep. All right, David, thank you very much. Interesting week. I hope that this week is as exciting, although maybe not too exciting. Let's calm it down a little bit.
Yeah, or not. We can just
As long as it's good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the price went up, not that price is the only thing, but it did go up a lot this week, I think. So
yeah.
All right. Well,
all right,
everybody,
thank you.
Enjoy the weekend.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Bye.